about some of the poetic elements that we should look for today? Well, we talked about parallelism. That's almost every psalm will have some form of parallelism in it, and it's basically where the author says something, and then he says it again in maybe a slightly different way, or he might say something and then say the opposite right next to it. So we'll see that. There's also some word pictures. There's a picture here where he describes God as being his shield. So again, he's trying to paint a picture for us, and so we want to see that. There's also some symbolism. David was a military man, and this was during a military time where David and his family had left, and he's being pursued by Absalom's army, his son. And there's actually a phrase that he uses here that's a military phrase, and it's symbolic, and we're going to look at that. There's also some wordplay, which we haven't seen a whole lot of yet. You guys know what wordplay is? It's where you use a word, and you might repeat it a certain way, but you're sort of playing off it, and you're trying to use it to communicate in a specific way, but we'll see that in a little bit. And then there's also something else that he does here that's part of the poetic element of the psalm, and it's where he switches between the second person and the third person, where second person meaning you, he's talking to God, but then third person where he's describing God. And he kind of goes back and forth a little bit, and so he adds a little bit of dimension to the psalm. Sometimes when we write, we'll write always in the second person, you. Sometimes we write in the first person, me, I. Well, he does a little bit of that where he mixes those up in here. So from a poetic element, I'll try to point out some of those things as we go through it. But the last thing we want to just touch on is the structure of the psalm. This psalm is the first one we have with a prescript. That's part of the structure. It's not, again, inspired, so you sort of pull that out of the psalm, if you will. But there's 8 verses in this psalm, and you can break the psalm down into 4 groups of 2 verses. So you basically have 2 verses, 2 verses, 2 verses, and 2 verses. Kind of like Psalm chapter 2. That one was 4 sections of 3 verses each. This is 8 verses make up the psalm, but 2 verses go together, the next 2 go together, the next 2 go together, and then the last 2 go together. And then lastly, from the structure, there's actually a flow in the psalm. David starts out in total despair, and he ends up in total confidence. And so there's actually this progression that David tries to show us where he goes from complete despair, then he gets a little better, a little better, and a little better. So there's this flow to the psalm as well, to where, in some respects, you almost think of David sitting in a cave somewhere, cowering in some respects, afraid for his life, crying out to God, hiding from his enemies. But the psalm ends where you almost see David standing up with his fists in the air, shouting, crying out to God to save him, but not in a state of desperation, but in a sense of absolute confidence that God is going to do it. And so there's this neat little flow to the psalm as well that is intended by the author. And it's actually from that flow that we get our theological understanding of the psalm. In other words, what we can do with it, what we should do with it. So we'll look at that as we go through this. But let's start out with the first 2 verses in Psalm chapter 3. David says this, O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God. And then you see this little Selah. Selah, when you see it in the Psalms, they're not really sure exactly what that means. It could mean that there's a musical interlude that takes place there. It could mean that there's a pause that takes place there. Not really sure, but it's something you see fairly frequently in the Psalms. But it's a pause of some kind, either, a musical interlude where the singing stops, or maybe a pause where they just have some silence. But the first 2 verses here, we see David actually crying out. And so I'm going to kind of do some alliteration with this as well. So we're going to use some C words today to help us remember this. So let's just say it this way. David cries out in despair. That's your first C. And so David, at the beginning of the psalm, we see him crying out in despair. Now, you remember, this starts out with this prescript that this psalm was written by David when he was fleeing from Absalom, his son. How many of you actually remember that story? Anybody here remember the story of Absalom, David's son, as he tried to kill him? It's actually found in 2 Samuel chapter 13 through 18. I'll give sort of a brief rundown here, because it's kind of like a soap opera. David had multiple wives, and he therefore had multiple children by those multiple wives. And so he had one son who was named Absalom. Absalom had a sister named Tamar. So David's son and daughter by one wife, Absalom and Tamar. He had another wife, and he had another son, actually from that wife, and his name was Amnon. So you have Absalom and his sister Tamar, and then you have a half-brother to him, another child of David, called Amnon. Well, Amnon sort of fell in love with his half-sister, Tamar. And he wanted her as his wife. And what ends up happening is he sort of, and I'll spare some of the gory details, but he takes advantage of his sister and does some things with his sister that are not right. And as a result, Tamar's sister Absalom gets very, very upset and kills Amnon. So he comes to the rescue of his sister and kills his half-brother. And when he does that, he then flees because he's afraid that David, his father, is going to be upset because he just killed another one of David's sons. Does that make sense, or is that a little bit cloudy for you kids? Two brothers, one of them has a sister. This brother did something to this sister that wasn't very nice. And so this brother kills the other brother to try to, I wouldn't say help his sister, but to try to redeem or honor his sister. And so then he flees and he runs away. Well, David is heartbroken because he lost one son. He's also heartbroken because the other son ran away. But David is angry. And so even though his heart is broken and he wants his son to come back, he refuses to forgive his son, Absalom. So his heart's broken because of what happened, but he just refuses. He can't get over what his son has done, and so he refuses to forgive him. Well, at one point, his military commander of his army comes to him and sort of tricks David into bringing his son Absalom back. And so David finally allows Absalom to come back to Jerusalem, but he refuses to see him for 2 years. So he lets Absalom come back, but he makes Absalom sort of stay off by himself, so Absalom can't see his father. And you guys can imagine that you know, as a son, he's longing for his dad to forgive him, wants his dad to forgive what he's done, but his dad refuses to do it. And so as a result of that, Absalom becomes very, very bitter. And at some point, David finally forgives Absalom, allows him to come before him, but by this time, Absalom is so jaded and so upset that he decides he wants to steal the kingdom from his dad, David. He wants to be king. And ultimately what happens is he runs David and David's family, the rest of David's family, out of Jerusalem, and David has to go on the run, and now Absalom has control of part of the army, and the people in Jerusalem now see Absalom as as their king of sorts. And he even does some other things to sort of make that happen that we won't go into here. So David is on the run now. David's afraid for his life because now Absalom isn't just happy that his dad David has been run out of the city and is no longer king, if you will. He now wants to kill David because he knows that he has to kill David the king, otherwise he'll never really be king himself. So even though he's in Jerusalem, kind of living in the palace, if you will, he won't really truly be king until he kills his father. So David is on the run now from his son Absalom. And that's when this psalm is written, because David is afraid. He's out in the wilderness, quite possibly hiding in a cave of some kind, because he's afraid Absalom is going to kill him. And again, if you want to read the story, you can go to 2 Samuel chapter 13 through 18. It's a pretty long story. Ultimately, in the end, David's army ends up killing Absalom. David refused to kill his son, which is a great testimony to David. Even though Absalom was trying to kill him, David refused to kill his own son. But one of his commanders killed him. So you can go and read that story if you want. So what do we find here? So David, as he's out in the wilderness, as he's facing this persecution from his son, the very first words we see out of David's mouth is the name of God. He cries out, O Lord. And the name he uses there is the name Yahweh, which is the most personal, the most intimate name for God. And to know that name means that you know the kind of God that you're serving. And so part of the reason why David, I believe, cries out with Yahweh, he's going to use just the generic term for God a little bit later, but he's going to refer to him as my God. But it's interesting that he cries out here with the most personal name for God. And it's because David knows who God is. He's in a relationship with him, and so he can use that name. And we're going to see why that's important here in a few minutes. So he begins to cry out by using God's most personal name. And think about this for a minute. David is a great military man. In fact, many commanders today in the army and in military and whatnot still, in some respects, will look back at David and recognize he was an amazing military man. And so David, while he's in this point of despair, fearing for his life, instead of trying to strategize and figure out the best way to capture Absalom, begins by getting on his knees and crying out and praying. Tells you a little bit about where he was at. He might not have thought much of his own military abilities at this point. Or he might have just realized the desperate need he had for God to rescue and deliver him. So he begins by crying out to God. He's surrounded by his enemies. Look at what he says. How my enemies have increased. Many are rising up against me. That's your parallelism there. But you notice something else. Look at verse 2. His enemies are so confident that they make this pretty bold statement. It says this: there is no deliverance for him and God. In other words, what they're saying is, David, even God can't save you. Now imagine that for a minute. You know, you've been serving God for a good part of your life now. Your son rises up to kill you. You get run out of Jerusalem. You end up out way in the wilderness. At that point, you might be wondering, where is God in all this? And while this is happening, you have your enemies out there. You can actually hear them taunting and chanting, and they're screaming at you, David, you better just come out, because God himself can't even save you. And I want you to put a little mark there, because there's something that David does a little bit later that's tied directly to this statement that they use. When they say, there is no salvation, there is no deliverance from God, even he can't save you, David's actually got a response for that a little bit later. And that's the word play that we were talking about earlier. So as David considers his fate, the despair that is consuming his heart at this point, he cries out to God. The question I would have is, what would your response be? How do you respond when you face a difficult situation where despair begins to set in? Is your first thought to cry out to God? Is your first thought to get down on your knees and begin to pray and beg God for his help? I'll be real frank, there's been a couple of instances in my life where I would honestly say I got to that point of near despair. One of them, and I'll give you kind of a positive example here, one of them was when Kimberly was diagnosed with a tumor years ago. We were initially told in our consultation with the doctor that he was pretty confident it was cancerous. And the type of cancer did not have a very good survival rate. And we were completely caught off guard. And I remember we had recently changed to that pediatrician because we wanted a Christian pediatrician. And Amy and I discussed it, and I said, I want somebody that if we ever run into an issue, we can pray with the doctor. And here we are, just a short time after, I think our first or second visit with him, and we're being told that Kimberly's got cancer. And right there in the office, we prayed with the pediatrician. And it set the tone for how we were going to handle that. And I remember the course of that week. This was, what, I think on a Monday, or was it a Friday? A Monday we found it out. And by Tuesday we were over at Children's Hospital meeting with others. And for the course of that week then, we had the surgery and all the stuff that was going on with that. Didn't find out until Friday that the tumor was actually benign and not cancerous. But there was that was a long week to have to go through. But I'll be real frank. Amidst all the fear, there was a tremendous amount of peace, even in the midst of all of that. And I remember the emails that I would send out to people. And just, it wasn't so much that I believed God would heal her as much as it was God just offered a tremendous amount of peace through that difficult time. And you would think I would learn my lesson from that. But I've got another quick example. And it's when Amy was diagnosed with MS. You know, we were learning about the medicines and stuff, and initially the insurance company said that the medicines wouldn't be covered because they're a specialty medicine, and I think we were looking at $6,500 a month to pay for her medicines. And I was just devastated by that. I'm like, we can't do that. I couldn't work three jobs and cover that kind of expense. And so I'm thinking, okay, which means my wife doesn't get the medicine she needs, and she's got MS, and that whole thing is scary because, you know, I've known a number of people that have had MS that were wheelchair-bound and some that didn't, you know, didn't survive ultimately. And I think it was probably a week or two that I worried about that, trying to figure out how am I going to pay for this and is there anything we can do and what if we just send, you know, Amy to work and try to do... And it all of a sudden just kind of started clicking. I'm like, you know, you haven't been prayed. It's been like a week and a half, 2 weeks. You haven't been prayed about this. You would have thought I would have learned my lesson and what God had done with Kimberly. Just... you know, a few years earlier. And so finally, I remember the day I kind of went, oh, duh, and I kind of confessed that. I said, you know, God, here I am. I'm worried about this. I'm struggling with this. And there's no way, no matter how much I can analyze this, no matter how much I can tweak this or work through this, there is just no way we can come up with that kind of money, period. This isn't going to happen. And I was ashamed that just a few years earlier, what God had done through the situation with Kimberly, you would think that I would just have learned my lesson. Start by praying. Start by crying out. And yet here I was analyzing and worrying about it and everything else. So the real question again is, as we look at David here, and David faced despair, the first thing he does is he cries out. And again, he was a great military man. He had every reason to think, I can take care of this. But instead, he finds himself in total despair, and so he cries out to his God. Let's go to verses 3 and 4. told you we're going to give you some C words to help to alliterate this. I'm going to just say here, David changes his focus. That's your second C word. David changes his focus. Now remember, he begins this psalm with his eyes on his enemies. He's looking at his enemies. Remember, he said, "My adversaries have increased. They're rising up against me. They're saying to my soul." And so he's got his eyes on his enemies. But David does something here. He begins to change his focus. And it happens as he begins to pray. Look at verses 3 and 4. "But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the one who lifts my head. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy mountain." So he sets up this great word picture here. A shield. What's a shield used for? Any of you kids? What's a shield used for? Yeah. Yeah, it's primarily a defensive. You can use a shield as an offensive weapon, but it's primarily a defensive weapon. It's to deflect the blows, right? Somebody's swinging a sword at you, and you can deflect those. It's there for protection. And so David uses this great word picture. Again, he's a great military man. And he says, "You, Lord, are a shield about me." In other words, he's now realizing God is going to have to be the one who protects me in this. And so he uses this word picture for us to help us visualize God sort of coming down and being this shield around him. But he also uses what's called an idiom. An idiom is a fancy saying, but it's symbolic. You know what a symbol is? Any of you kids know what a symbol is? Yeah. Yeah, it's something that represents something else, okay? And so he gives us this interesting picture here. Notice what he says in the second half of verse 3. He says, "My glory and you, Lord, are the one who lifts my head." Well, that's a little bit interesting, isn't it? The one who lifts my head. If any of you guys have ever seen, say, war movies where people are captured. You know, I just recently watched The Great Escape, and all the prisoners are coming. It's a World War II movie. All the prisoners are coming in, and most of them are walking with their heads down. Okay, when you walk with your head down, why do you typically walk with your head down in this situation? It's shame, right? And so prisoners are captured, the heads are down. Well, this idea of lifting the head was a military term used to bring somebody up back to a place of honor. And so to lift someone's head meant to restore them and to put them back into a place of honor, as if they had been captured, they're now a prisoner, they've been defeated. So this is symbolic. So this is an idiom. It's actually used in a couple of other psalms where the same phrase is used, to lift one's head. And so what David is basically doing here is saying that God is not only his protector, but God is ultimately the one that's going to bring him victory and restore him back to his place of honor, which I believe David was referring back to his kingship back in Jerusalem. He knew that the only way that would happen would be through God. But it's interesting that this takes place, this idea of realizing God is my shield and God is the one that is going to restore me to that place of honor, only comes about as David begins to pray. And so his focus begins to change as he prays, and his eyes move from looking at his enemies and looking at his circumstances and looking at the situation around him, and now begin to focus on God and God's character, who God is, and what He can actually do. And so he actually changes his focus. And you can already begin to see David's confidence build here. Look at verse 4. He says, "I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and He answered me from His holy mountain." He already tells us God answered his prayer. He's not even halfway through the psalm. He's about halfway through. But he's already reminding us here that God has already answered his cry for help. And so we begin to see his confidence change as his focus changes, as he takes it off his circumstance and his situation and puts it on God and God's character and who he is and what God does. We see his confidence begin to grow. Let's go on to the third section, another C. David commits himself to God's protection. He's going to have to take some steps now. This is verses 5 and 6. So he actually commits himself to God's protection. Now he's going to do something rather remarkable. And I think it's an amazing display of confidence. Look at verse 5. "I laid down and slept." How easy do you think that would have been? David's out there fearing for his life. His enemies are getting ready to attack. And David decides he's going to take a nap. How many of you could do that? If you were afraid and frightened, how many of you could just, "I'll go ahead and I'll sleep. God's going to take care of me here." I don't think I could. It's always boggled my mind, and maybe Brian, you might be able to answer this, but it's always boggled my mind how in the world you look back at any situation in war, and these guys are in foxholes, how in the world they can sleep out in a foxhole somewhere. Enemies surrounding them, cramped quarters, muddy, dirty, cold, wet. I guess you have to get to that place of total exhaustion for you to be able to do that. But we don't get that impression from here. We get the impression from here that David was able to sleep because of his confidence in what God was able to do. It wasn't about complete or total exhaustion. He finally just gave it up and he could sleep. But rather, he's telling us that his confidence has now changed. He was crying out to the Lord. The Lord answered him, and therefore, verse 5, I was able to lay down and sleep. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. You see David's confidence change there? He's saying, I'm not going to be afraid. I'm able to lay down and sleep. And he even gives us a little picture here as to why that's possible. David says that it was God who sustained him. He says, I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. There's some question with this verse as to whether the translation should read that he sustains, kind of like this present tense, or whether it's past tense, he sustained me. In other words, is David saying, I went ahead and I laid down and I slept, and God raised me up or woke me up because he sustained me? Or if David is saying, I laid down and slept because God is the kind of God who sustains me. Do you see the difference between that? Some of your translations say that David is basically saying, well, I laid down and slept because God protected me at that moment. I was able to wake up. Other translations treat it as, I was able to lay down and sleep because God is the kind of God who sustains me. That's what he does. He does that all the time, past, present, and future. And the question is, which of those two things does David have in mind here in this particular verse? Most translations actually translate this as a present tense, because that is probably what David was trying to communicate. David isn't simply saying, I went to sleep and God woke me up. He's saying, I was able to go to sleep because God is the kind of God who sustains me. That's his character. That's what he does. And that's what David is trying to communicate to us. Not that God simply took care of me in that one instance out there in the wilderness. So most translations actually translate it that way, as a present tense, and I think that's probably the most appropriate. From a strictly grammatical or syntactical standpoint, there's no way to know for sure. But again, most translators take it the way that I suggested here. And we see again that his confidence grows because he says, I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people. You know, what's interesting is we see this same principle elsewhere. The reason David has so much confidence at this point, and why we see his confidence grow from this place of total despair now to where he's able to lay down and sleep because he trusts God, it's a principle that we find in the Scriptures, and it has to do with what God does. In David's case, he says, God is the kind of God who sustains me. That's why I'm able to sleep. For us, if we look, and we don't have to turn here, but in James chapter 1, we're given probably one of the most famous passages on dealing with trials and difficulties in a Christian's life. And James tells us that we are to consider trials, which is what David was going through, an opportunity for joy, which seems a little counterintuitive. But he tells us why. He says it's because we know, or in their case, because you know, James says, because you know that God will use it to build endurance in your life. And what's interesting is James, as he describes that, uses a word that indicates we know based on personal experience what kind of God God is. And so when James tells us to consider trials or times like this that David's in as an opportunity for joy, what he's saying is you can do that not because I'm simply commanding you to. You can do that because of what you know about God and what he does with trials. So when you begin to reflect on the kind of God we serve, who he is, what he does, that then gives us the ability and the confidence to do what David has done here and to trust. It gives us the ability to do what James does, which is to say, this is an opportunity for joy. Because I know the kind of God I serve, and I know what he's done in the past. And so what James is trying to do is to call them to reflect back on their past and say, hey, what has God done with previous trials in your life? How has he used those? What has he done? Has he sustained you? Has he grown you? Has he protected you? What has he done? I look back at situations like Kimberly's surgery and Amy's diagnosis as MS and some of the medical health issues that I've struggled with myself. And I can honestly tell you that there's a tremendous amount of confidence that comes in looking at those things and going, wow, God has not failed me not a single time. Look at what he has done. And all the worry and all the fear and all the angst that I felt in those times were wasted energy. And looking back on them, I can say God did exactly what he should have done as God. And those things now serve me well as I struggle and deal with other issues. And David is able to do that. And so there's this principle here that we find that by reflecting on God and who he is and his characters, and his character, will help us to get through those difficult times. And David saw that here. So the last C, if you will, that we have here is David calls on God to deliver him. And so he committed himself to God's protection by going to sleep. But now we see David's despair is completely gone at this point. Verses 7 and 8, David calls on God to actually deliver him at this point. So if he watched David move from this despair to trust, we now see that his despair is completely gone and it's been replaced with confidence. He says, "Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God." But then he says this, "For you have smitten all my enemies on the cheek. You have shattered the teeth of the wicked." Did you catch the word pictures there? He says, "You've smitten my enemies on the cheek," which means you've given them a blow to the cheek. It's like punching them on the cheek. Okay. But then he also said he shattered the teeth. There's this image of a friend of mine years ago used to use this, that Satan may be like a roaring lion running around trying to devour us, but God has removed his teeth. Kind of an interesting picture. And that might be sort of a picture that David has in mind here, as a lion of sorts or a wild animal that God has taken and crushed out the teeth and now there's not much bite left to him. He might be able to gum you to death, but that's about it. And so there's this amazing word picture here that David wants us to see as we see this, that God has shattered their teeth, given them a, you know, think about that. How many of you kids have ever been hit in the mouth? Anybody? That just kind of knocks you out, doesn't it? It's sort of like, yeah, it hurts. You don't want to do anything at that point, you know? That's a difficult place to be hit. It's an uncomfortable place. And so to shatter somebody's teeth or to punch him in the jaw, to hit him in the head like that, can basically deliver a pretty devastating blow. And that's the image that David wants us to see here, that God has basically hit him in the most vulnerable spot, if you will. And so he's got this amazing confidence at this point. He's calling on God. God, rise up. And you can almost see David now starting the psalm, cowering in the corner, simply because he's afraid. He's hiding from his enemies, his son Absalom. But now it's like he's come out to that entrance of the cave and he is ready for battle. And he's basically standing up. He's got his fists in the air. And he's now saying, "All right, God, this is it. Rise up. Deliver me. Take it to my enemies." Very different picture. Now, we have something else that's kind of interesting here, and I mentioned these tenses a little bit before. When he says, "You have smitten, you have shattered," again, there's some controversy and question as to whether that's supposed to be interpreted as past tense. "You have smitten, you have shattered." That's the way the New American Standard and the King James translates it. The NIV translates it as a command, "Strike their teeth, you know, break their teeth." A couple other translations translate it as, "You strike" or "You break their teeth." Again, kind of a present tense. Again, that present tense idea is probably more appropriate, that what David is saying is not, "You have struck my enemies, you have already crushed their teeth," as much as he is saying, "This is who you are. This is what you do to my enemies. You crush them. You strike their teeth. You break their jaw. That is the kind of God you are." And so again, this kind of a present tense aspect of God is probably what David is communicating. Not so much that he's already done it to the enemies, but regardless of that, the idea is that David is so confident, it's as if it is already a done deal. David treats it as if God has already done it. He's that confident in God's ability to save him at this point. And again, that all comes because David took his focus off the circumstance and put his focus back on God and who God is. Now, here's something else that's interesting about this. I remember I told you when his enemies earlier said, verse 2, "There is no deliverance for him in God." Remember I told you to put your finger there? There's a word there, salvation, or deliverance, same word, that his enemies use. And they say, "There is no deliverance in God. God cannot even save you." Well, David here uses the same word when he says, Arise, O Lord, save me. He uses the same word, but then he does something else. He says, salvation or deliverance in verse 8 belongs to the Lord. So what David's just done, he's done a word play on us. And it's not as easy to see in the English because some translations in your English, like the New American Standard, uses saved in one place and deliverance in another. So you don't know they're the same word. But they're exactly the same word in the Hebrew. And David does this for a very particular reason. He has just taken his thumb and stuck it in the eyes of his enemies. They have said, David, even God can't save you. There is no deliverance in him. And what David has said is, oh, you got it wrong. Deliverance actually belongs to the Lord. That's a pretty bold statement. Because while they're claiming God can't even save you, David's saying, oh, you don't understand it. God owns that. He is the only one who can save. Salvation is his. Doesn't that tell us a little bit about our God? You know, when we come to Christ, you know, and we pour out our lives to Him and we confess our sins to Him, He is the only one that can save us. And what's really interesting is that some of us struggle with that. I struggled for years with the concept of eternal salvation. Because my sins sometimes would come to the forefront and I'd look at it and say, how can God save me? And you get that doubt. Well, He can't. I'm too wicked. I'm too evil. I'm just nasty. I can't get over these darn sins. They just continually consume me. And it's at that time that we got to go, wait a minute, no. God owns salvation. He is a God of salvation. He saves because He owns it. And that's what David does here. And so he stands up and he sticks his thumb in his enemy's eyes and he says, no, you got it wrong. You may claim that God can't save me, but God owns salvation. It is His to give, and He gives it to me. That's a pretty bold statement. It's a statement of confidence. And so he uses a neat little wordplay that, again, is a little bit hard to see in the English, but from the Hebrew perspective and poetry, it's kind of remarkable. Kind of remarkable. So, what do we do with this? What's the primary point of this? Well, what we see in this psalm is that David is in despair. Many of us, at times in our lives, have faced that to one degree or another. If you never have, in all likelihood, you may someday. So what do you do with it? How do you handle it? Well, David gives us this great example. The theological principle, if you will, from this can be summed up this way. We move from despair and fear to hope and fearlessness when we shift our focus off of the circumstances and onto God. Plain and simple. That's the theological principle. That's what James teaches us. When you're in despair, when you're facing a difficult circumstance, when you're in a trial, you can continue to look at the circumstance and situation and find yourself in despair, or you can do what David did, which is cry out to God, take your eyes off the circumstances, look at God and who He is and what He does, and realize the kind of God He is. And indeed, that salvation is His. He will rescue and deliver you from that difficult time. And again, that's the principle we find in the book of James. We are guaranteed. James tells us that God is a good God who only gives us good things. He rescues us. He delivers us. He helps us through our most trying times. But the problem is, oftentimes we get stuck focusing on the circumstance. And just like David, we end up in a cave, cowering, worried, until it dawns on us, wow, I got to put my eyes back on Him and on His character and who He is. And then see that despair dissolve and grow into confidence, hope, trust, and faith in Him. Pretty simple principle. So, I'll go ahead and I'll leave it with that. And we'll continue on in our study of Psalms. But I hope that was a challenge to you as well. Like I said, it's been a practical one for me just because of some of the issues that we've faced. But I'm going to go ahead and pray, and then we'll just sing a couple of songs. Father, thank you so much for this challenging word from David today. I can't imagine what that must have been like for him, having one of his own children rise up against him and try to take his life. And yet to find himself having to reflect upon you. And so we thank you for his example for us today as we go through difficult times in our own life, that you might help us to remember to take our focus off of the circumstances and situations around us and instead turn our eyes to you, that we might, like David, be able to go from that place of despair to complete and total confidence, not because their circumstance changes. In fact, for all we know, David was still in the cave when he was writing this psalm. But to have the confidence that you can rescue, save, and deliver us comes from simply recognizing, like David did, your character. You are the kind of God who does these things. And we thank you for that reminder this morning. We pray for all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.